Recorded live from Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and all of the other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Welcome everybody to season 4, episode number 17 of Cinematica. My name is Dan Slevin, and here with me in the Cinematica studio is Howdy Stranger.
Howdy, how are you? Are you good, mate?
I'm good.
It's been a wee while. I've been coming for these Wednesdays going, I don't know what to do. Like, you know, it's
have you been sitting here on your own I've been I'm missing something.
What is it? Podcast, you know, I've had podcast, you know, what is it? You know, I've forgotten the word for it now, but
withdrawal symptoms.
It's been missing my podcasts. So there you go.
Well, I'll tell you what, we missed you too. We went out, for those of you who are unaware, Kaylee and I have been on the road doing our rock and roll tour of New Zealand, podcasting live to the people of the Civic Theatre in Auckland, and last week the Paramount Theatre in Wellington. I think it's worn her out though, because she's crook today. So we're going to have to do the show. We're going to have to bear up under the with just ourselves.
And she's all okay now, but she was a bit crook. Yeah, she got taken to A&E for the bag of saline.
Boy! That's good. No good. Yeah. I hadn't heard that. Now that's, I feel terrible because I was the one. I was going, so are you going to be there? You're going to be here?
Yeah, that's right. come on, you can do it.
No. Oh well, I hope she's listening at home. In today's episode, white guys go to Asia and cause trouble in two of our films, Only God Forgives and The Wolverine. Plus, we ask whether stage magic can translate into screen magic with the thriller Now You See Me. But first, we won't have a look at what's in the mailbag because that's Kaylee's job and she's not here, so we'll have to catch up on all of your feedback.
We're missing a limb, aren't we?
We are. She's so vital. But what we can do is we can find out what people have been going to. What's the top five there, Sime?
Okay, the top five we have hanging in there a little bit. There's The Heat at number 5 this week.
Still holding on.
It's been going for a wee while now, 4 weeks. The Conjuring at 4.
That is doing a massive business in America still. And I read a statistic this morning that said that The Conjuring has now made more money than all of the Paranormal Activity movies put together.
You're kidding.
Yep.
Oh my goodness.
So it just goes to show, actually, you know, make a proper film about people who are setting up cameras to catch ghosts and people will come.
Yeah, it doesn't spin my propeller, but
no,
there you go.
Well, and at some point, or we haven't reviewed it on here, I have seen it, but maybe that's something we can do when we do a big sort of catch-up when the festival is over in Wellington.
Yeah. And what do we got? Number 3, Despicable Me 2, which has been around for 5 weeks.
And school holiday's long over now as well.
Yeah.
So that must be just a strong weekend, really.
It's just the weekend. Still going strong, though, it's got to be said. Like, it's pretty strong numbers over the weekend.
So I watched a film in the film festival today called Like Father, Like Son, which is a Japanese art house movie. It was by the guy who made Nobody Knows, and you know, like it was a really, really strong film. But it's made by partly funded by Fuji TV and movies, and their logo that plays at the beginning are two minions from Despicable Me.
Is that right?
So everybody at the embassy, like,
it's confusing.
The first logo shows up are these minions.
And you go, oh, you had the right. What's going on here?
Exactly. Yeah. This is the festival, damn it.
Yeah, Despicable Me too. At the festival. Check it out. Now then we have The Wolverine at number 2. So he's straight in there.
Mm.
But so interestingly, and this is, you know, this is a 4 week. So and at number 1, Now You See Me.
Ooh, that's interesting. So, you know, but the big disappointment for me, and we've done these stats for a few weeks now, is that The World's End hasn't yet managed to crack the top 5, I don't think.
No, it's in there at 8.
For all of the publicity and all of the attention and all of the great reviews and responses, that's a film that just hasn't.
It's
caught
in it,
fire,
yeah.
Has
it was.
It?
I mean, it's kind of sat there though, hasn't it, at that level? Because it was at number 8 the week prior, yeah. So it's not.
Is it because it's rated? It's R13.
R13.
Yeah. So do you think that that's maybe had it? No, R13 doesn't keep many people out, does it?
Not really, no. I mean, the heat's an R13, and that's sort of doing more.
I think that there's something's gone a little bit squiffy there, because it's not like they didn't put everything into publicity for it.
Yeah, no, that's very true. I mean, interestingly here, it is funny though, like when you get these kind of, when you probably compare it, it'd be interesting to compare it to the other previous two films of theirs and where it sits box office.
I don't think either of those were huge either, were they? I think they're more cult than big slam bang box office. But I would have thought that over time that there would have been enough fans generated for those to have had a stronger lead off, but so it just hasn't happened. And I mean, they're also interestingly that this has not been a day and date internationally.
No, it's been released by territory.
Exactly, and they're going, and basically it's opening along with the visits of the stars.
Yeah, they're working it hard, aren't they, from
that
point of view?
Exactly, but I just wonder whether that means that maybe there was a little bit of, the fact that New Zealand got it first might have meant that, you know, there wasn't a kind of critical mass of attention or...
Dan, mate, you want it first, you don't want it first. Look, you know, the movie-going audience, I can't believe you're saying that. You want to be first in the world, don't you?
I'll tell you what it is. I do believe, this is from when I used to run a picture theatre, when I wanted stuff to come with a reputation already.
You want momentum, don't you?
You do, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, quite often with art house stuff, we would get films straight, you know, before Australia or before the rest of the world, and you didn't have any reviews that you could pin up on the board.
It's hard work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I do think that for some things, you really want people when it's something that doesn't have it's not part of an established franchise, perhaps, or, you know, it doesn't have a comic book to write on the back of, or, you know, you've got to do something, and actually big numbers from the US does help.
Yep, no, I completely agree. And what stands out for me a little bit in this chart here, though, is that NT Live, the audience,
Helen Mirren,
went from 11th to 10th in that week.
Yeah.
And it's in the top 10, you know, and that's pretty good. I mean,
tickets are more expensive for that, though.
Oh,
aren't
yeah, NT Live, the tickets are usual.
Well, so in terms of bums on seats, as it were, it probably wouldn't be. I mean, do they weight those for things like 3D and for the more expensive tickets?
No, they just have
gross.
Yeah, I mean, they do have a reference to 3D, so you can separate out, you know, revenue, the 3D revenue versus the regular, but not for the alternative content like NT Live and things like that, or the Met. You know, Met again is dearer than the NT Live. So, but you know, like, I think it's just interesting. I think these, you know, the strength of the live shows coming through is getting better and better.
Yeah, interesting stats on 3D coming out of the US, in that basically the bottom's fallen out of the 3D market in domestically in America, but it's now 50% of the box office for those big tent poles. When 3D is available, 50% of the money is 3D internationally. So in places like New Zealand and Australia and the UK and Asia, of course, as well, and the rest of Europe, 3D is going strong. But in the US, seems to have run its course.
Well, and also I think people are just a lot more selective than they might have been in the past about 3D. They're gonna, you know,
they've been burned a bit.
Well, you know, there was just a lot to choose from, and now, you know, maybe when the Despicable Me comes out or the Epic and those films, they decide to, but not necessarily. You know, they're family films, aren't they? So there's a lot more sort of thought that goes into them, and it's funny because I you know, my kids, I don't think. I think often it's the adults that want to see it in 3D, not the kids. You know,
they think the kids want to see it in 3D because it's going to be, you know, a bit cooler. I remember taking my niece to see her first 3D movie, which I think was Wall-E in 3D.
Yeah, Wall-E was.
It was Up. Up was in 3D, yeah. And I thought she would be really into it. I thought she would love the involvement and what have you. And in the end, like, it didn't take very long. About 20 minutes before she was putting the glasses down at the end of her nose because they were a little bit uncomfortable for her. And it's like, oh, okay, now I'm just looking at that. This actually isn't a thing, really, for you. But then I took her to Epic in 3D more recently, and she was into it. So maybe it was an age thing.
And interestingly, like, I reckon, you know, like Beyond the Edge, which is that film about Sir Ed, you know, coming out later on the year, will be in 3D.
And you'd have to. You'd have to watch that in 3D.
You would. So, you know, there are certainly films where I think, you know, it'll fit perfectly.
Indeed. Well, time to go to Thailand.
Your brother was murdered. When? Yesterday.
Did you get the guy that did it?
It's a little more complicated than that, Mother.
Meaning what exactly?
You can't go around killing cops anymore.
If the tables were turned, your brother would have found your killer, brought me his head on a platter.
Ryan Gosling reunited with Nicholas Winding Refn and Only God Forgives. And I saw this over breakfast this morning.
Did you keep your breakfast in?
I did, just about. But actually, you know, it occurred to me that maybe watching it, this was a film that, because of the film festival, I couldn't watch at a screening. So I ended up watching it at home. And I'm kind of glad I did. I think if I'd been stuck in a cinema with, like, just completely with this thing sort of coming at me non-stop, I think I might have struggled a lot more than I did with it. I think it was kind of good to be able to just look away for a moment or two, because it is one of the more full-on cinema experiences that you'll have, isn't it?
It's interesting you say that, because I saw it in a theatre, like, right.
Intense,
like,
isn't
intense.
It?
And yeah. I came out of it feeling absolutely like I've been through the ringer. I felt traumatized.
Yeah.
By the film. I really did.
It's
maybe I'm a little softy at heart, who knows.
Maybe we found your weak spot. This is a film where Ryan Gosling plays a young guy who is living in Bangkok, and he's sort of hanging around the gyms and the kickboxing sort of fraternity. His brother, his older brother, is also there. His older brother, who's a bit of a bad boy, it would have to be said, gets himself into some trouble and gets murdered.
Yeah, but yeah, and
we don't want to say quite what he does.
Yeah, but I mean, it just, well, in some ways you have to, because you got to show how mean spirited it is, you know.
True,
and it
true.
Has this meanness to it the whole way through. I mean, his brother is doing awful stuff. You know, he wants to do awful stuff.
Yeah, exactly. He wants to do awful stuff. By way of revenge, he gets done over, and then the chain of revenge just continues to sort of work its way up through the family, including Kristen Scott Thomas as the boy's mother, in a part that I don't think I've ever seen her play a part like that.
No.
Now, this is a film that is really dividing audiences. I mean, Simon, you've just said that you found it too much.
Well, I did, because you know, it's because it pretends to be art when it's not. I think that's what really annoys me about it, is that it's trying to be art, it's trying to be clever, it's trying to be really smart and all these, you know, like, and yet it's a pretty, it's actually a really slow, violent, exceedingly violent, and lacking in any charisma kind of film. It's just mean. I mean, the people in it are mean. There's no one to like. Gosling kind of mumbles his way. He says maybe 10 words in the film, as far as I can remember. Like, he doesn't say much at all, except he looks good. And the policeman in it, who is kind of like the Grim Reaper,
He's trying to tidy everything up, isn't he?
Yeah,
you know,
but,
like, clean up the streets, but he's making more of a mess.
I don't know if he is. I'm not sure about that. Because what he is, though, is this kind of divine...
Avenging angel.
Yeah, he is this avenging angel. Like the father that takes... I mean, you know, because it gets a bit confusing, but the older brother does something nasty to a young prostitute, and the policeman brings him in and says, right, Dad, you know, sort him out. And he does. He's got no choice. His father's got to sort him out, and he does. He beats the crap out of the brother. And what you find, though, is that then the policeman comes in and says, right, now you have to pay.
Yeah.
And the father's like this poor peasant, and he says, well, what do you mean? I did what you wanted me to do. And he says, no, but you let your daughter enter this life and work this one. He goes, I got three or four daughters. What am I meant to do? You know, they can't... What am I meant to do?
Yeah.
And he has to pay this terrible price. And you kind of think, well, like, you know, I'm not saying I'm happy about any father that sells their child off into prostitution, but, you know, what sort of decent, you know, like, you don't you don't keep punishing people like that, and that sort of thing carries on throughout the film.
It does. Everybody's got a reason to be punished.
Yes.
Except probably for Ryan Gosling himself, who seems to get dragged into it unwillingly. Because the very first thing he does is he's sent by his mother to go and achieve some retribution, and he turns the other cheek, doesn't he? He says, well, you know, look, you know, my bro did this really bad stuff. I'm not going to take revenge. And his mum basically says, no, listen to what I'm telling you. This is not how it works.
Mm.
And so you sort of, he's sort of corrupted, isn't he, as the film goes on, but then there's a minor redemption for him at the end.
But he's also like, has no real personality
of his own. None whatsoever.
He's very dull.
This is a film that, as I was watching it, I found myself admiring all of the craft that had gone into it. It looked beautiful. The colors, the framing, the composition of every shot, the cutting, the slow-mo periodically, the return to the structural sort of stuff, which is like the return to the karaoke periodically. There was a hypnotic aspect to it. I sat there
and the music,
I
like the music in it.
Yeah, the music was fantastic.
Really interesting. Yeah.
And, you know, there were lots of things that I really admired, but I'm a little bit like you, it was hollow for me. And I just wished, you know, if this was a first-time filmmaker, if it wasn't Nicholas Winding Refn and it wasn't Drive,
yeah,
you would say, this would be a really good showreel. Let's give you a script.
Mm. Yeah, I completely agree.
Let's give you a script because you can do this.
But seeing what he's done with Drive and then to go to this type of offer, I thought was really, you know, I was really disappointed. And, I mean, I think in some, you know, for a lot of cinemas, it's virtually unplayable. Like, you know, there are a lot of cinemas that would struggle to play in. And, you know, and I'm a little bit surprised it's not in the film festival, actually, because I think, you know, when you look at it, it is actually, maybe that's what it's tailor-made for, is the sort of festival art house market, you know, at the festival.
And I have to say that some of the critiques that we've just offered of it are critiques that I felt would have applied it to a lesser degree with Drive itself, you know, that...
The violence in Drive was necessary, and it was kind of... not glamorized, but like you say, it's filmed so beautifully that it kind of makes the violence look interesting, you know, like, or if that's the right description. But to me, the violence in there was relevant to what was, you know, the people and their characters and the story, whereas this is just excess after excess after excess of violence, you know, and you're cringing, you're shifting your knee up trying to hide, you're doing all those sorts of things.
It's Drive distilled down to its essence, almost, you know. It's like all the excess, not the excess, but lots of stuff stripped away down to a core, which is basically this sullen, mysterious guy on a mission and trying to seeking redemption.
But if you want to see 5 minutes of somebody being tortured, it's great, you know, and in slow motion with beautiful music in the background, and it's wonderfully shot. But to me, that, I mean, so what, you know, I mean, that.
It is hollow. I walked out of a film at the festival yesterday called Heli, a Mexican movie about a young guy who gets involved with some drug dealers. It was at the point that he got strung up and the cricket bat or the paddle got brought out by the drug dealers that I thought, oh, you know what, I don't need this in my life. And went out and did something else for a while. But that was embedded in a kind of gritty, urban Mexican drug dealer reality, whereas there's something fairy tale like about Only God Forgives, isn't there? There's something, the fact that it is so glossy and the colours are so primary, and there's everybody's intentions are reduced to very, very primal. There's nothing sophisticated about anybody's thinking in any of it. It's like, you've done this to me, I have to punish you, or that you've done this to my family, I have to punish you, and it's, everything's reduced to...
But it's also, I'm not just going to punish you, I'm going to punish everyone else in the room.
And like, your family.
Your family. And I mean that scene where one of the assassins gets taken to bits, essentially, in front of, like, you know, in a big karaoke, and it's all very beautiful, you know, like everyone's in 1950s kind of clothes, and the women are stunningly attractive, and they're all sort of singing Asian karaoke, and it's all slow motion, and this guy, and people are just sitting there without moving, like, nobody moves.
Yeah, except these tableaux, they're like paintings.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, Yeah, okay, but for a whole film like that, it's just, you know, I think, and the thing for me about Drive, going back a bit, is that it was violent, but it wasn't just this continuous barrage, and so it really did shock you. Like, when it hit hard, and it really had a point, you know, like it was relevant. This, to me, is like, well, okay, this guy's going to pay a price, but he's going to pay a price, you know, again and again and again and again over the next 5 minutes. You know, what's the need?
Okay.
I was bitterly disappointed given Drive. I was really disappointed.
And
Gosling,
builder.
You know, yeah. I just love, you know, I love Drive. I love watching Gosling. And I just thought, this is a real disappointment. You know, you could have, your ambition should have been a lot higher.
Right. I didn't hate it as much as you did. It's one of those ones that I think I might. It sort of defies analysis, really, which is again a sign that it's actually not very deep, but it is just so beautifully constructed, like all the craft aspects of it. Anyway, so that's my two words for it: is beautifully hollow. Have you managed to come up with two words? Can you reduce?
Just bitter disappointment.
Oh boy. Okay. Time for some news. Doing my best BBC voice now. Reports are coming in of Walt Disney Pictures estimating their losses on The Lone Ranger at $190 million. That's US. It's about the same, isn't it, nowadays?
Well, not really.
$190 million US is what they're going to write off on The Lone Ranger. At the same time, the stars Johnny Depp and Armie Hammer, director Gore Verbinski and producer Jerry Bruckheimer have come out in public this week and stated that bad reviews are the reason for the film's failure.
Yeah, no, well, you just need nice reviews all the time. You'll be fine.
Yeah.
No matter what you put out.
Yeah, and that makes all the difference. Yeah. The movies, the cinemas will be full all the time.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was rewatching Lincoln the other day. Now Arnie's in that, isn't he? Doesn't he play the love interest for? Isn't he the guy that plays opposite DiCaprio in
J. Edgar Hoover?
J. Edgar.
Yeah,
it's Arnie, and I was like, there he is, and he's actually pretty good.
He is good.
But you know how we were talking earlier on about the Lone Ranger, and the guy, like, why is he there? You know,
he's not a movie star yet.
Yeah.
This is the thing, is that, like, you'd go to the pictures and you'd see that these beautiful cardboard standees for the Lone Ranger, and it would say Armie Hammer, and I can tell you that not one person at Queensgate and Lower Hutt would have walked past that and gone, you know what? I got to get me a ticket for that sucker, because Armie Hammer is in it. Because you know his name. His Armie is short for Armand.
Nice. The Armand.
Because his grandfather or his great grandfather was Armand Hammer, the oil magnate who
J. Edgar, wasn't it? What am I saying Lincoln for? You loon.
I don't know what you were talking about.
Take yourself aside and have a word.
I'll clip that out.
But J. Edgar.
Yeah, J. Edgar. He wasn't too bad in J. Edgar.
Yeah, he was great. I thought he was really good. You know,
Would you watch J. Edgar twice, though?
Oh, it's a neat film.
Okay.
It's an interesting... you know, I'd rather sit through that twice than Only God Forgives. You know, like, I could quite happily.
Fair
know.
Enough, too. Yeah. A grant of $120,000 from the Christchurch Earthquake Appeal Trust has pushed the New Zealand International Film Festival and the Christchurch's Isaac Theatre Royal a lot closer to their goal of making the venue the permanent home for the festival in the city. They only need another $30,000 now to pay for the fit-out and the conversion of the Isaac Theatre Royal into a state-of-the-art movie theatre to go along with all of the rest of the repairs and renovations that are going to be happening.
Well done. But it's going to be a live venue and theatre.
Yeah, it'll be like the Regent in Dunedin and the Civic in Auckland, in that it's most of the time it'll be a performance venue. I think they've already got advanced bookings to 2017 for things like opera and ballet. And the film festival really does deserve a great home in Christchurch. You know, it's been hard done by from an art house perspective, and I think it was, you know, $30,000. If it's so close, listeners, if you just put your hands in your pocket for, you know, $5 or $10 to help them out, you can push them over the edge, I reckon.
Could work.
By the end of the Christchurch Festival. In more South Island cinema news, Hoyts have announced that they're leaving the Octagon in Dunedin. There's been a cinema on that site since 1911. But fear not. Yes, all is not lost for Otago film fans. Reddings have announced that they're going to pick up the lease and refurbish the complex and reopen in early 2014.
So that's an interesting thing to happen, wasn't it?
Yeah. So do you have any insider information on that?
I just wanted to know if Hoyts had, knew that there was... Well, there must have be other players looking at it.
Well, this is the thing, is that when you're leasing a site that is a picture theatre, you know that the landlord, if you don't come up with the dough, the landlord's going to go and find another picture theatre operator, because the only alternative is to knock it down and turn it into a car park, right? And no one wants to do that these days, because that's an expensive exercise in itself. Even though the rate of return on car parks is way more than it is for movie theatres if you're building them. But once you've got one, you might as well keep it, right? So there was always going to be somebody likely to step in. And Reddings do still seem to be the only big chain that are expanding, you know?
Hoyts are expanding around the place up in the North Island, yeah. Well, they did Te Awa not that long ago.
Right. I'm a little bit behind the times. I know that Event are doing a really good job of maintaining and looking after the properties and the sites that they now operate, having bought it from Sky City. And I know that they've got a good reputation as good operators, but I don't know if they're opening much, are they?
No.
How many screens are at the Octagon, do you know?
I'm not sure if it's 4 or 5.
Right.
Something like that.
Yeah, and it's a fantastic location. And if you know Dunedin at all, you'll know that it's just it really is the perfect spot for a cinema. You know, walking distance for basically everybody. Certainly, a lot of the Scarfies. Hello there. This is Thursday morning, Dan, butting in on Wednesday afternoons. Dan, version of Dan. Last night I got to interview Matteo Garrone, the director of Gomorrah and the new film Reality, which opens next week around New Zealand. And I thought, seeing as I was editing the show this morning, we might as well drop it into the show for you rather than make you wait a week. So here we are. I spoke to him on the telephone. He is from his home base in Rome. Reality is a film that started out life as a comedy. He thought it was going to be a comedy, and it's about a fishmonger in Naples who dreams of appearing on Italy's version of Big Brother.
Hello?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes. Okay. Sorry about the line went down.
That's all right. It's still, even though it's the 21st century, we still have these problems. I'll just ask you, first of all, after Gomorrah, you were compared with the greats of neorealism, Italian neorealism. Reality seems to have more in common with somebody like Fellini, the faces, the parties, the Big Brother decadence, that grand fairy tale wedding opening scene. Tell us how you came up with the idea for Reality and what you were wanting to achieve with it.
Yeah, well, after Gomorrah, I wanted to try to make a different movie, a different genre. So we tried to... We decided to work on this story that is a true story that happened in my family, that happened to the brother of my wife, and it was a story that seems a sort of modern fairy tale, but at the same time it could be a comedy, a dark comedy, and. And we decided to try to develop this story, and this is how reality comes. it seems very different from Gomorrah, but I don't think it's so different after that we made. It's Gomorrah was a movie about crime system and the point of view of the leading actor, of the leading character, was that they were victim of this crime system. And reality is a movie about show business system, and the point of view is from the victim at the same time of this system. So I would say it's not a movie about, more than a movie about television, it's a movie about audience out there. You know, it's
indeed.
In a way.
Is reality TV a very big thing in Italy? Here in New Zealand, we have talent shows like New Zealand's Got Talent and those sorts of things, but we don't have those sorts of TV shows where lots of young people live together under one roof with the cameras all the time. That seems a very unusual thing. Is it very popular?
Well, once. Three or four years ago, yes. Now it's not so popular, but you know, the Big Brother in the movies, like the MacGuffin, you know, in the Hitchcock movie, it's not really important. It's important the sort of artificial paradise that the main character wants to reach. It can be also another program, and it doesn't matter. So it's a movie about illusion, you know. It's a movie about dreams.
Yeah.
And that's the point.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I remember when I heard about this story, I was very surprised by the fact that this character, Luciano, that is a sort of naive and very impure in a way, guy, start to create a new character to reach his goal. And so he became a sort of saint, for utilitary reason, you know, reason. So this aspect connected to the mask that he invent. It reminds me an Italian writer that I love very much, that is Pirandello. And probably it's this aspect connected to the human conflict are the reason that pushed me to tell this story.
You were born in Rome, and I think, do you live and work in Rome at the moment?
You were born in Rome, but
your two most successful films are set in Naples. For New Zealand listeners who don't know Italy that well, what's different about the two cities, and what inspires you about Naples?
Yeah, I see. But it's a coincidence, honestly. It's a coincidence because, when I start to work on the book of Gomorrah, the producer got the rights of that book and invited me to work on that project. And then after Gomorrah, I wanted to change city and to go away from Naples. But this story happened to the brother of my wife, and my wife is from Naples. So I said that probably was honest in a way to remain faithful to the city where the story happened. So it's a coincidence, but I like very much to shoot in Naples because Naples is so full of inspiration, so full of so rich of visual inspiration, incredible actors, characters. So I love to work in Naples, and the most difficult things to when you work in Naples is to try to put order in the chaos, because it's so chaotic and so rich that you have to put order and take the decision and follow your decision, because if you follow everything, you became mad in a way. But I love to shoot in Nepal.
Your lead actor, Aniello Arena, he has a face that was absolutely made for film, but he's not made any films before you discovered him. His backstory is fascinating, though. Could you tell our listeners how he came to be in your film?
Well, I saw Aniello Arena in theater. He was the leading actor of a company of theater that I like very much. And I was really surprised by his talent and by his face and his eyes. So I said that probably was the perfect actor for this story. And it was not easy to get the permission from the judge. But, you know, we've been lucky because at the end we succeed and I think his work and also his personal story bring something unique to his performance, you know, because he really discover something during this journey, because, you know, he came from 21 years in jail. So when he shoot this movie, during his journey with this character, he really was surprised by what he discovered, you know. And this movie, it's also a journey about accounts, you know. So it was very important for us to have a character that can see and be surprised by the way how country is changing, you know.
Yeah, there's an innocence about him, but there's also a sort of darkness as well as the film goes on. It's a really wonderful performance.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, it's the second part became very, very dark and the movie changed tone and the problem of Luciano became existential in a way. So for him to reach his goal to reach his to be in television, doesn't matter the program, it means to show to everybody that he exists. So it became a sort of existential problem, and that's why the story became dark and dark.
You like casting non-professional actors. Does that mean that you're always on the lookout for faces and characters that you might use one day, or do you stop and then you have a casting process?
There is a big misunderstanding, because it's in reality all the actors come from theater, are all professional,
just so not cinema actors.
poor actors, because they are all from you know, they some comes from television, some from cinema, but all are professional actors from theater, you know, some from cabaret, you know, comic, but all are professional. The only one that is not professional is the old lady that buy the little robot, the old lady that buy the little robot and became angry with Luciano because he didn't want to to take back the little robot.
Oh, well, forgive me for...
Non-actors, but all the family are all actors.
Forgive me for making the mistake. They look like they're just plucked from the streets.
Yeah, I know. You're not the first, so I know. But I feel sorry for them, you know, because they are all... In Gomorrah, I mixed some professional actor with some, not for principal rule, but for a small rule, in small role, they were also known actor in Gomorrah.
Right.
In reality, no.
You started as a painter, as an artist before moving to cinema, and this particular film has many arresting images, like canvases. When you're looking for locations and places to shoot, do you still have your sort of painter's eye for architecture or for scenery?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, the visual aspects are the most important things. So it's very important to find an idea of how to tell the story and a visual idea, and then we try to follow this line. In this case, the story was in a very subtle line between, you know, realism and fantastic dimension. So it was very important to find location that could be believable as a working class family, but at the same time that can bring the audience to another dimension that is more the dimension of the fairy tale, more fantastic. So that's how we developed the square where he works, that was built by our director. And also the house where they live. So this aspect was very important. At the same time, so we choose also location like the outlet or the commercial center or the water park, where you can feel like if you already are in a sort of television reality show, or in a set of a television program, or a fiction.
That's right. Yeah, there's something unreal about them. Something a bit too glossy, a bit too colorful.
Yeah, yeah. And also the costume was important. It was full of color, like a Pixar movie in a way. So like the face must be like, you know, a cartoon, you know, like so this was but my way of work is the same also in the other movie. Of course, also to me also Gomorrah was a sort of black fairy tale in a way. The beginning of Gomorrah is like a science fiction movie, and the ending of reality is like a science fiction movie. So my way of work to me seems not so different from the other movie. So, but I try to think how to tell the story and how create the image of the story. And then, of course, we shoot Gomorrah in a way that could seem to the audience more documentaristic than reality. But the work behind it was the same.
Right. Reality won the Grand Prix at Cannes in 2012, which was your second film to do that after Gomorrah in 2009. The film is still making its way around the world. It was opened in the US and the UK in March, in New Zealand next week in August. Do you have time to think about new work and new projects, or are you spending all your time doing publicity for this one?
Now this time I work immediately after reality. I work immediately on a new project, so I have the new script, and so I hope in the earlier of the next year to start the shooting.
Well, Matteo, we all look forward to seeing that next one. We're hoping that lots of people in New Zealand will go and see Reality when it opens next week. Thank you very much for being on Cinematica.
Thank you. Thank you very much to you. Thanks, Doc.
Come in close, because the more you think you see, the easier it'll be to fool you.
Ladies and gentlemen,
for our final trick,
we are going to rob a bank.
On the count of three, you will be teleported through space and time to your bank in Paris.
One, two,
three. Everyone in this room was a victim of hard times.
Some of you lost your homes, your cars.
And so tonight,
we're going to return some of that money back to you.
Now You See Me, which is the number one film in the country.
It's a good opening.
It is a bloody good opening for a film that doesn't have support of the majors, even though it's a it's full of movie stars and it's, you know, it's a pretty commercial picture. It is still, it's being distributed by Hopscotch /Rialto. So they don't have huge resources at their disposal, do they?
Well, Hopscotch were a sort of they've got E1.
That's true, but in terms of local marketing they don't have the deepest pockets in the world.
No, and it is the Rialto distribution company here that's releasing it, and so they I think it's had a good presence. I think it's had a good lead-in.
It certainly the trailer worked really well, and so if they placed that well in front of the right.
Which they've done. I mean, it's been trying for a while.
I would also point out that I was looking at where this was playing in Wellington yesterday to try and find a session that I could fit in between festival films. I think this might be the widest release that Wellington's ever seen. I had to scroll on my flicks.co.nz app on my phone. I actually had to scroll for another screen to get all of the sessions in. I think it's playing everywhere, except the Embassy, of course, because the Embassy's loaded up with the film festival. But it's everywhere from Upper Hutt right through to Island Bay, I think. And interestingly enough, I watched it on film at the Paramount. It was actually a 35mm print, one of those, like, it was like going back in time.
That is like going back in time.
You know, a secondhand used print from the American release, scratched up.
We had a screening today where an elderly woman was a bit unwell during the film.
Of that one?
No, not that film, a different film. But it was just, with film, it was a nightmare to stop.
Yeah.
Sort it out, you know, get somebody out of the theatre. Whereas with the digital, we just paused it, came in, lights went up, explained to everyone, and they were absolutely fine. Because, you know, you've got to look after this lady. So we got her out of the theatre, pushed play, and off we went.
Yep. Yeah, well, the screening I was at yesterday, the sound wasn't on for the first through the trailers or the opening titles, and I thought, this is going to be a mission, you know. Like if it's busted, I've got to go out and complain. They've got to rewind it. My timing was all out. I have very fine tolerances in terms of me being able to get from one screening to the next. As it turned out, by the time I'd actually got out into the corridor to alert somebody, the sound had come back on, so it was all good. Now we should probably talk about the film. I've seen it. You haven't.
I haven't yet, I'm afraid.
This is it's a kind of an old-fashioned caper movie.
It's a bit of a Robin Hood, isn't it?
It is a bit of a Robin Hood, but it's about four street magicians or street illusionists who are brought together by a mysterious figure, shadowy figure, to fulfill a particular plan. One of them is Woody Harrelson. He's a mind reader or a mentalist. And we've got the guy from the Facebook movie.
Jesse
Eisenberg. He plays the great sort of stage magician. Isla Fisher, who is Sacha Baron Cohen's Mrs. She is an escapologist. And there's also... a fourth member of the crew, somebody you won't recognize. Anyway, they all get brought together in New York to form this mysterious company called the Four Horsemen. And then we jump forward a year. They're playing Las Vegas. They're managed by Michael Caine. And there they are on stage in Las Vegas. And they are going to, their final illusion is to rob a bank. And they somehow manage, this is the mysterious aspect of it, they somehow manage to rob a bank in Paris, France, and empty the vault of €3 million and then scatter the money down from the heavens, above the audience. And of course, you know, there's a robbery, and so the police get involved. Cecile de France, I think it is, who is the beautiful Interpol agent, Mark Ruffalo.
Melanie Laurent.
Oh, it's Melanie Laurent. I was getting confused. No,
sorry, I just...
Why did you leave me hanging for so long? You've been looking at... You've got it on the screen.
I know,
there.
I just thought, you know, let him go a bit further.
Boy, oh boy, Melanie Laurent. Anyway, yeah.
She's lovely too.
Yeah, yeah, anyway. Exactly. So yeah. She's Interpol. Mark Ruffalo, got that right.
Yep.
He plays the FBI agent. Anyway...
And my name is...
Michael Caine, exactly. And yeah. Also another, you know, Morgan Freeman's in there as just to muddy the waters. And he's a magic expert whose job, he makes his living debunking magic acts. Now, I had a bit of a problem with his character, actually, because I don't believe that anybody could make a living putting YouTube videos debunking how magic tricks are done, because nobody really wants to know.
Of course not.
They want to believe that it's real. It's real, exactly. Yeah. So that was just one of many problems that I had with the whole world that they've created for this particular film. You really do have to buy into it early, and you have to buy into it. You have to be as much of a sucker as a normal magic show audience has to be. You've got to get into it, and you've got to want to believe it. And I struggled with that, I have to say. The show moves to New Orleans, and there they steal Michael Caine's money and give it to the audience, because it turns out that everybody in the audience
They've been carefully selected, and they got
stiffed by the insurance after Hurricane Katrina, and so there's this Robin Hood thing going on. And as it all builds to this climax in New York City, a show in an abandoned warehouse where the public are being invited. And, I mean, it's kind of nuts, really. It's the magic itself is... It's interesting, you know, how stage magic shown on film easily benefits from film magic, which is you can cut.
Mm.
You've got various digital tricks that you can do now. You can move your camera around.
Yeah, where are you going to be positioned and all that sort of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it felt a little bit cheaty, you know, like watching magic happen on a stage where you know that whole misdirection thing. There's a craft of the magician and the magician's assistant doing that stuff to you, whereas on film, the director of the film is doing it, you know, directing your attention away from one thing and to another.
But if it's immersive, then...
Yeah, if you're into it, you're into it.
Yeah, and that sort of rolls along, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And I've seen some tweets by a few people who said that it actually benefits a lot from a second viewing, because a lot of the clues that you don't see first time around are actually there. So it's very carefully constructed. I have two problems with it. Not that it wasn't entertaining, which it was. One is that it doesn't really know who it's about, because it starts off being about the four horsemen and the magicians, and then it disappears from them for a long period of time and becomes about the cops and follows the cops around. And then we go back to the magicians, but there's no character development for them. Mm. You know, like they're functional. They're there to provide sort of plot, plot drive, you know, propulsion. So that's a wee bit of a problem. The other problem I had is that the camera will not stop moving, and it's like one of those old U2 videos from the mid-80s where somebody will stand in the middle of a street and the camera will just go round and round and round them, and it was like, stop moving. I was feeling quite motion sick, actually, right, for lots of it. And
you're a hardened vet. I mean,
I know, which is why the funny thing was, watching Only God Forgives this morning, it was like, oh, the camera just sits still.
It sits still, but it doesn't move at all.
No, it doesn't. He paints pictures, doesn't he? Like, going back to Only God Forgives here, but he does. He paints these pictures, beautifully composed, the colours, light bulbs will be in just the right part of the screen to balance, you know. It's almost perfect if you don't pay too much attention to what's actually going on in the middle of the screen, whereas Now You See Me was so busy and so fussy, I had to sort of look away, you know, for different reasons. So I had some stylistic problems, I had some character problems with it, but somebody described it as I always forget the name of this film. This is how much it's completely blanked. What's the Christopher Nolan Inception?
Inception, yeah.
Which I keep wanting to call it Insomnia because that's what it did to me.
I like Inception.
Right. Well, this is Inception in Vegas, yeah. Basically. Mm. And it's a puzzle, and if you're into puzzles and if you and that sort of stuff, you'll want to work it out. And at various points in the film, you'll think you've got it.
Yeah.
And it'll pull the rug from you a little
bit.
See,
that's great, isn't it?
It is great, but
it's nice to do that.
It is. And I'm sure that the audiences, and as we know from number one film, audiences will find it really satisfying. It wasn't really for me entertaining enough, but I wouldn't want to go back to it.
You got two words for it?
Yeah, stop moving.
Stop moving. Nice.
All right, time to go to Japan now. Shame Kaylee's not here for this one.
Yeah, I can do a magic trick. You know that thing with your thumb where you...
Yeah, I think that's the wrong angle.
Yeah, well, you see, I broke my thumb, so it doesn't kind of...
I can see behind your hand.
Yeah, I know. It doesn't kind of work, you know, and Kaylee spent hours teaching me this. I don't know why it's like left brain, right brain, but anyway, there you go. Like,
okay, so Kaylee's an illusionist as well.
She's got that thumb thing going on.
Wow.
Where you pull your thumb away.
See, this is what happens when she's not here. Mm. You know, you miss out on all of her other skills.
That's right.
Anyway, she shared the screening of The Wolverine with me in Auckland last week, so sorry she's not going to be here. Actually, I'm just going to look and see how long the show's been going on, because it might pay to just hold off and wait for her to come back next week, and we'll do The Wolverine
then. You can do that if you like. That's fine with me. I haven't seen it. Might give me a chance to check it out.
Yeah, well, and I think what we should do next week, because the festival will be over next week, what we should do is we should do a as fast as we can rundown of everything commercial that we've seen since the festival started, and we'll just try and do a little...
We'll just
try and bang out as many as we can, because it's been busy. We haven't done Ping Pong, which is doing enormous business in the over-70s market. There's all sorts of things that I haven't seen, and I need to do a big sort of catch-up.
Hortense, did you watch that?
Is that open?
Looking for Hortense, yeah, it opened. Opened the same week as Now You See Me.
See, this is the thing, is that I'm completely
There's
out of
the one that played in the festival last year that opened on Thursday as well, about royalty.
The French, yeah. What's it called? Playing
Queen, something. Farewell, My Queen.
Farewell, My Queen. Right, see, so there you go. So I'm going to spend the film festival in Wellington finishes on Sunday, and actually there's still extra screenings being added for Monday and Tuesday as well. But I'm going to try and catch up and do a massive, because I haven't written a film review for 2 weeks as well, so I've got people on my mailing list who are just crying out to find out what it is they should be going to see. So what say we just hold off there and give ourselves and our audience a bit of a break, just to let you know, if you didn't hear any of the other two shows that we've done around the film festival, do go back to iTunes or to the website and download those, because there was some really, really good, interesting stuff with great guests. I just want to go out of my way now to say thank you to the film festival. I think it's been the guest quality for the film festival this year has been absolutely outstanding. I think it's really gone up a notch, and the fact that so many of the guests have gone to see each other's films and they've hung out and they've done panels, and there's a real sense of event around the festival.
You want that community, don't you? And
yeah,
you want it
exactly.
Mingling. And I think that, you know, that it's great to have that vibe going on, isn't it? And it's maybe a little bit different to some of the earlier festivals.
Yeah, I think it's something
it's
that
building.
Happens. Yeah, it is building. It's something that happens a lot at festivals internationally, but it is, and it's always been harder to get people to come to New Zealand, Wellington in particular. But it's happening, which is great. So in next week's show, we're not going to have time for any reviews, are we? Next week, having made all of those rash promises, because we're also going to be talking to Neil Jordan, the director Byzantium.
And don't forget, Elysium opens on the 15th.
I tell you, we've got another interview as well in next week's show.
Yeah, in the way, way back.
Yeah, another interview in next week's show. I'm talking to the director of Stoker, Chan Wu Park, on Saturday. He's in Auckland for the... big screen symposium in Auckland.
There's a cinema in Wellington and around the other main centres doing some flash mob free screening type events.
Of Stoker
this Friday night.
Right. So how do people find out about these?
They have to just go to the check out the flicks.co website, and that'll have all the information about where it's playing and at what time and so on. So
all right.
It's Yeah, no, it's an interesting little ploy that sort of creates some momentum for the film.
I think that's a film, particularly with people, you know, so filmed out at the moment. You know, you need something to sort of raise people's expectations.
It starts at 10:30. I'll probably be at home with a cup of cocoa. But, you know, you guys, you young fellas, get into it.
Indeed.
And check it out.
And also on next week's show, we'll be giving away a couple of double passes to the Matteo Garrone film, Reality. So that's all that on next week's show. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to click subscribe in iTunes or your own favourite podcasting software. So the latest episode is always downloaded automatically. Leave us feedback at the iTunes store. We haven't had reviews for a while, but ratings are still coming in. They're super useful to help people discover the show. You can also contact us. Oh, this is something that came up last week as well, is that somebody at one of the festival screenings leaned over, showed me their iPad and showed me that the Cinematica logo was featured in Film Comment magazine, which is the magazine for the Film Society of Lincoln Center in New York. And I was like, what is this? A bit of further investigation shows that the article was actually about Letterboxd, and the screenshot of the Letterboxd site had our ad on there.
Fantastic.
So there we were in Film Comment, so woohoo for that. You can find us on Letterboxd. We're under Cinematica, Facebook.com, Cinematica Podcast, Twitter, Cinematica Cast, and you can also find us at our website, cinematica.co.nz. The show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music is 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke, which you can buy at the iTunes store. We're leaving you with some more music. This is Cliff Martinez from Only God Forgives. Wanna fight? Indeed. until next week, that's all from me.
And it's good night from me.